Hi everyone, this is Graham Cowan and welcome to the Caring CEO Podcast. We created this podcast because we believe that every leader's number one priority is to build a more caring and resilient team who enjoys growing together. It is my job to interview CEOs and other senior leaders who value building both a culture of care and a culture of high performance. I'm very keen to understand how they do this, and I'm sure there'll be lots of insights and tips for anyone who wants to build a high-performing team. I've just finished interviewing Danny Gilbert, who's the managing partner of Gilbert & Tobin, a large Australian law firm. Danny shares how he started the business with Tony Tobin 33 years ago and that it has now grown to 1,000 employees, which he never envisaged when he started that. Danny has quietly spoken, but there is no doubt about his drive and constant quest for continual improvement. Before we spoke, I did some research on Glassdoor. This is a website that allows current and past employees to review their employer. And just looking at a few of the comments in 2021, great culture, lovely team, progressive, honest, and hardworking. Leadership is great. Parental leave is the best in the business. Great innovators and fun place to work. Gilbert & Tobin has also had a significant pro bono practice. And this is something Danny has championed since the start of the organization, as he really believes we all have an obligation to create better communities. Danny has personally had a long history at improving the lives of Indigenous people and is deeply committed to this cause. Danny has shown remarkable capacity to reinvent the business and take it to new levels, and it continues to win industry awards. It is really worth listening closely to Danny. There is a lot to learn. Enjoy. Welcome, Danny.
Thanks, Graham.
Danny, what does care in the workplace mean to you?
Well, pretty simple proposition, I think. It just means trying to build a culture where people look out for each other. People basically care about the people they work with, care about their well-being, care about building interpersonal relationships with them, not just transactional relationships, having some knowledge about people, about their lives, and a preparedness just to engage in the ordinary everyday conversations of life. That's what it means that on a daily kind of basis, when things go wrong in people's lives, it requires the demonstration of an elevated sense of care and responsibility.
When we spoke previously, you used the word decency. And how do you define that in a work sense? Is it similar or is there any difference?
Pretty basic stuff. It's about treating people as you would like to be treated yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and being open with them, being respectful, being kind and recognising their own individual humanity.
33 years ago, you and Tony Tobin decided to start the firm. Why did you want to go out by yourselves?
Oh, well, we just wanted to not be part of the big firm we'd been in and just the excitement of building a practice ourselves, really, and just seeing how it would go. Not that, you know, I set out to build something as large and as significant as G&T today, just kind of grew along the way. Not that it grew without a strategy and thought, but when we started it, we thought we'd just have a fairly small, manageable little practice.
So you never envisaged that you now have 1,000 people?
No, I was quite shocked last week when I heard that.
What do you think is really the important ingredients of a good young lawyer working with Gilbert & Tobin?
Oh, well, they've got to be smart. They've got to be able to empathise with their clients and what their clients need. They've got to be able to assemble information, understand the legal issues, understand the commercial imperatives of what the client's looking for and deliver a product that's appropriately shaped to meet the client's expectations. They've got to be capable of working in a collaborative environment, working in an environment where people care about each other.
And I also read a...
And be ambitious and determined to succeed and a capacity to work hard.
And I also read, was a speech I think you gave at the University of New South Wales, that you think lawyers should have a sense of responsibility to the community as well. Why do you think that's an important element for lawyers?
I think it rounds them out as human beings, and I think that we should not lose sight of the privileged position we hold in society. And society has conferred on lawyers a special status. Now, lawyers might say they've earned it, that's probably right, but they only earn it because society has decided to confer the opportunity on them, and they don't allow everybody to do it. You have to meet certain requirements, and that should be regarded as a privilege and should be considered in the backdrop of the best traditions of the legal profession, and those traditions include a commitment to the greater good.
And you've had always very big involvement in pro bono work with Gilbert and Tobin. What has that done for the firm, do you think?
Well, I think it creates an added sense of purpose for the firm. Mm. Even people who don't personally engage in pro bono work, I think, feel pleased, if not proud, to belong to a firm that has that commitment. Hopefully, as part of the DNA of the firm, that this is what we should do. We give back to the community in an area where our skills really allow us to do that, our skills as lawyers. And I think that all lawyers should have a commitment to the rule of law, and the rule of law can only really be served if you live in a society that has some kind of reasonable standards of justice and equality before the law. I think we're all obliged to make some efforts to contribute to that.
You've personally had a very long history in working to help Indigenous people. What started that mission for you?
Oh, well, I got involved with the Catholic Church at Redfern, where I was looking to get engaged with the community of Redfern and understand what was happening there. And this was in the early 80s. And there was a lot of need, and I got involved with all sorts of Indigenous people and Indigenous issues through that. And that extended to engagement with Indigenous leaders across the country after a period of time.
I read in a recent book put out about the 30-year history of Gilbert and Tobin, Noel Pearson wrote a very glowing introduction for yourself and also Tony Tobin. So I gather he's been part of the firm or been involved with the firm for quite a period of time as well.
Oh, well, he's been involved in the sense that I have a very close relationship with him, going back a long time, 15 or more years, and I co-chair his Cape York group in far north Queensland, and we do quite a lot of pro bono work, and I am engaged with Noel and other leaders across a range of activities, the most important of which today is constitutional recognition of the voice.
When you reflect on your 33 years with the firm and how it's grown and changed, has it been a really tough time you've been through at some stage that you were really challenged?
Oh, yeah, there's been points at which the partnership, over that period of time, you'd expect there are points at which the partnership might become divided on issues, and it's always a challenge to sort of keep your head down and remain resilient and be determined to continue to chart your course through those things and maintain a clarity of what it is you're trying to achieve. Not always easy, but there have been some difficult moments there, but nothing that, looking back with the benefit of hindsight, was too difficult.
What was one of those periods when, you know, the partners were, I guess, in different camps? What can you give an example of what that was?
Well, not really. I wouldn't want to go into it. Some of it's a bit personal. I think that at the time we I mean, just personal differences between partners. Those things have sorted themselves out over the years. One thing was a bit challenging was when we decided to break away from our brand as a media and technology telecommunications brand. So a boutique brand which we had developed strongly from the time we started to the mid to late 90s and early in 2000. I thought it was time for change and we should build out from that and aim to build a top leading corporate practice. And that meant taking on the establishment firms much larger than we were, with a significant history going back more than 100 years for some of them. The question was asked, well, what makes you think we can take on these behemoths and challenge them and take market share from them and build ourselves into a position where we're at least as good as them? I thought it was a pretty interesting and exciting challenge. Some people thought that we would destroy the brand we had in doing that and not achieve what we hope to achieve. Anyway, I think we've achieved much of that, so it was the right decision to make.
And what made you confident that you could do that?
We had success. We started the firm in 88. We had been successful in everything we tried to do so far in building a media and telecommunications and technology practice. I couldn't see why, with the right focus, the right strategy and the right people, we wouldn't be able to build a leading corporate practice. Just a question of thinking about those things and getting the right people and developing some clarity about what it is you're trying to achieve and having people by and large buy into that with you.
Yeah, very good. When you recall growing up, and I understand you grew up near Griffiths in New South Wales, in country New South Wales, what impact has that had on you in terms of how you live your life?
Hard question. Those are always hard questions to answer. I mean, I think it gave me, probably like many people who grew up on the farms, you had a very strong work ethic. You had no choice but to have a strong work ethic. Working hard was so normal, there didn't seem to be anything else, any other choice to make. And I think you had to strive hard all the time and you had to sort of battle away with the elements, I suppose.
My father had a country practice of accountants in Taree, and he always tried to hire people who come from farms because he said they knew about hard work and they would just have to knuckle down and do things. So he very much respected that approach as well.
I'd say it's only one of the elements, really.
When you reflect on...
I suppose going back into farming, there's one thing that you could see growing up. You could see the productive outcome of efforts made, which is not so easy to see in every other kind of line of business. But if you grow up on a farm, you're able to see that every year and you're able to compare your father's sort of own achievements against others and form some views about what makes a successful farmer.
Yes.
And, there's obviously a lot outside control as a farmer, but my father as an accountant said that there were very good farmers and not so good farmers in terms of how they manage their money and their stock and all that sort of things as well.
Sure, of course.
I had a look just this morning at Glassdoor, which is as you may know, a site that has details of people that have worked with you and in the past. And I just really looked at in 2021, and there were some really great things there. Most were 5 or 4 stars, and some of the things said great culture, lovely team, progressive, honest, and hardworking team. Great innovators. And you mentioned before about, your communications practice and how good that was. How do you have an innovative and progressive firm? What have you done to keep on reinventing yourselves?
Well, you've got to keep an eye on the future. You've got to look at what changes are happening in the community, in the business world. You've got to have a view about where they're headed, and you've got to be engaged with people who are at the edge of all of that. You've got to be listening to them and following the trends. And you can't sit still. You can't sit on your hands. And you have to be prepared to make the investment to engage with the right technologies. You don't have to be bleeding edge about it. And you have to give people in the organisation some space to engage with new ideas and new technology, and ultimately you have to employ the right people to drive it forward. You have to have a commitment to it, to really remaining at the very leading edge of technological change and thinking about it all the time and pushing.
And how do you keep a good eye on the horizon about knowing the trends that are happening across business, across government?
And you've got to be out there in the business community. You've got to be talking to people. You've got to read stuff. You've just got to make sure that you are engaged with what's happening.
Yeah.
And that is about developing connections, listening to people, reading, and being curious.
Yeah.
And make sure that you're employing people who have a similar approach. Curiosity is a pretty vital aspect of it.
You said before about, broadening the scope of the business, moving away from a communications and technology focus to, a broader view. Can you think of other areas in the past where you've spotted an opportunity and decided to invest in it and it's reap rewards?
I think all of the practice areas that we are now in today, we're here because they are successful and they're sort of profitable. We decided some years ago, I think, that we wouldn't stray into areas that, whilst they might be related to the practice of law, are not really part of the mainstream. So we decided we'd focus on being lawyers and delivering the best work we can do for our clients, but not straying into areas where the consulting firms and the big accounting firms were strongly engaged, because that probably wouldn't be the place where we could compete very well. So we decided just to stick to our knitting as lawyers, really.
Yeah, fantastic.
And some firms have got taken on risk practices, technology practices, providing technology services to their clients. We've played around with some of that, particularly in technology in the past, but it didn't seem to work as well as we thought we'd like it to. So we've stopped doing all of that sort of extracurricular activity now for some years. Long time, really.
Yeah. When you reflect on your career, what do you feel, is there something that you feel particularly proud about?
No. I'm pleased. I'm pleased that I've been with others, able to build a firm of the standing of G&T. I'm pleased with what it contributes to the community and to employment opportunities that we have for our staff. And yeah, they make you all feel pretty happy.
Yeah, I would imagine there's a lot there to be very proud about. When you can,
one can't afford to be too proud. it's a slippery slide down the other side of the hill. Pride leads to hubris. Hubris is a very unattractive quality.
When you consider the introvert extrovert scale, what side do you consider yourself, and how does that impact the way that you lead others?
Oh, I think I probably lean. I don't think I'm an extrovert, but on the scale, if there's a line over which you cross one to the other, I'm probably a bit more of an extrovert. But I could be a bit introverted in some ways as well. I don't think I'm, you know, would, people wouldn't describe me as an extrovert. Do you think?
Sometimes.
Okay. Sometimes.
It's very interesting with this show because most of the leaders and the CEOs I've interviewed would consider themselves more on the introvert side, but they say that they learn how to be extroverts. In fact, most would probably say that. So, you know, they might be more comfortable. They might regenerate their energy by being by themselves, but they also know very much on how to project themselves as well.
Yeah, no, look, I get my energy and ideas from other people. I need to have other people around me. I don't generate too much on my own. Oh, I'm okay in the shower coming up with ideas or at 3 o'clock in the morning, but a lot of people are like that. No, I'm probably on the extrovert side, but I'm not, you know, I can think of any number of people who are, yeah, it's a pretty broad scale.
It is.
It's not a narrow field.
No, not at all. When you think of high performing teams, what in your view is the real key to a very successful team?
If you're talking about lawyers, they have to be very good lawyers, they have to be smart, they have to have a very empathetic engagement with their clients and what it is that their clients are trying to achieve, and they have to make sure that they craft a product that meets those needs and not that falls outside those needs. That is not to say that the role of the lawyer is simply to do everything that the client wants or wants the lawyer to do or thinks that the lawyer should do, because our role is as independent advisors. But subject to that, and you always have to keep that in your mind, it's about crafting a product that meets the commercial outcomes that the client is looking for.
Mm.
And that, in a corporate firm, it requires lawyers who are capable of having a commercial approach to things, who can work out what issues matter and what issues matter less, discarding those that matter less. And when you're a transactional firm like Gilbert and Tobin is, you're inevitably dealing with large teams of people. Mm-hmm. And if you're a partner, your ability to project manage and show leadership for those teams is terrifically important. I talked about transactional work, but I'd make the same observation about complex dispute work, about infrastructure, about competition and regulatory issues as well. Yeah, so you want to have teams that are fairly cohesive, teams that exchange information so that everybody in the team knows what they're doing. But I think the empathetic engagement with the client and understanding the client is really key. You can be the smartest lawyer in the room and deliver a product that a client really does not have much use for.
If you believe like we do that a leader's number one priority is to build a more caring and resilient team who enjoys growing together, you may be interested in these three free resources we've provided at our website, factorc.com.au. The first one is the We Care Credo poster, and this contains the mindset and values of teams that prize self-care, crew care, and red zone care. The second resource is a poster called How to Support a Teammate in Distress. And this provides easy to follow instructions on how to identify someone who's struggling, how to have the Are You OK conversation with empathy, and how to guide them to the help that they need. And the third resource is a Building a Mentally Healthy Culture checklist. And this provides items to think about before you launch an initiative, how you do a great launch, and then thirdly, how to keep the momentum going following the launch. These three free resources can be found at factorc.com.au. How do you make it safe for people to speak up in team meetings?
I don't know the answer to that. I think you try to build a culture where people are encouraged to say what they think.
Mm.
I met with a lawyer today, a young partner, who feeling somewhat constrained by the pressures being put on him by another partner, you know, and I told him what he should say to that other partner. You know, and basically it was being direct and being rude if he chooses to. But people and should look after themselves. I say this to these summer clerks when they come and they're going to be working with people. Just look after yourself. Don't be afraid to speak up. Put mm-hmm. your hand up. So I think it's about encouraging that kind of environment. And where partners who have the power think that they can use that power to constrain the ordinary reaction or interaction of other human beings, that's not appropriate. And I don't like cultures that are really heavily informed by status and titles, because status and titles are really symbols of influence and power, and they don't really work well in building a collaborative environment. So I don't like all that crap, really.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm concerned, you know, it wouldn't never really, if a partner was to say to me, how dare that young lawyer say that to me or speak to me in that way, you know, that would not typically be a conversation which would garner much interest from me.
Yep. You've really chosen to make diversity a priority in the organisation. I guess that speaks to what you've just talked about. Why don't you think that, and I know that you have a pretty good record here, I think 36% of your partners are women. Why don't you think there are more women in senior leadership across Australian business and government?
Well, just answering your question, I mean, I don't know that I've actively chosen it. I would rather think, maybe I'm wrong, but I would rather think that the culture that I've talked about here is an attractive one for women. That where people are treated with respect, people don't bring traditional hierarchical views, and that would include, you know, traditional sexist anti-women thinking to the place. I hope we don't really have too much of that. I'm sure we have elements of unconscious bias, maybe in some instances conscious bias, but I think there's a sense of that's not acceptable here, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that progression and success at Gilbert and Tobin is just as easy for a woman as it is for a man. I think it manifestly is not. And you can just sort of, you've got to try to break down those barriers. But people bring those views to work, and it's part of societal thinking and the way that people are brought up. I'm not allowed to say, you can't, you know, just the way their parents and what they grew up in their household, you know, and what they bring to work. So, you know, but you also got to encourage women to speak up and push back as well. Although I appreciate that many women get pretty tired of doing that, find it a tiresome thing to have to do.
When you think,
I think we're okay at it, you know, we've had the benefit of a number of very successful women, senior women, who really, it's one of the best things you can do is have successful senior women in your business. It's a great role model. Not always, but mostly.
Yeah. When you think back over your career, has there been some really good career advice you've received from someone that you've really taken on board and it really had an impact on you? Can you think of the advice and the person that gave it to you?
Oh, look, nothing really jumps out at me. You have friends and you talk to people a lot about issues. I find that not so much in the early years, but mostly when you're engaged with someone and you're seeking their advice, you're coming at it from position of having thought about it a good deal. And so those people might help you refine it, help you shape it a bit more. But I don't think there are too many occasions where you sit down with someone and something you've never thought of is presented to you.
Hmm. Yeah, fair enough.
That doesn't mean that there's not room for advice, and it doesn't mean you won't get things wrong. But I've always been someone who has happily sought out advice from others.
Mm.
But then along the way, I would have taken advice from people about what it takes to build a leading corporate firm, that's for sure, both from partners internally and externally, from former partners as well. And I've learned along the way. I mean, whatever leadership skills I have, you know, I didn't have them when I started, that's for sure. just learn along the way.
How do you keep yourself in good physical and mental shape?
Oh, well, I try to exercise, but not as frequently as I'd like to. You know, I don't have too many stresses and strains outside the office. I have a long and happy marriage. I don't know, all these things help.
Definitely.
Last time I asked my wife, it was happy. I think she's happy.
Law has some high levels of emotional distress and as a sector. Why do you think it is so high?
I just think the demands of the work, you know, clients are demanding very quick results, everything. There are time pressures around every product that you deliver for a client.
Mm.
Time pressure, if you're a dispute lawyer, there are pressures that are imposed on you by the courts. And if you're doing deals, there are pressures imposed on you by the clients. And it requires, you know, pretty, the work is quite intense.
Mm. Yeah. So,
pressures to get a job done. And, you know, it's just not suited for everybody.
Mm.
You know, and, but, you know, we've had people who we no doubt, I know, we put under too much pressure.
When you started the firm, obviously you knew everyone's name and for quite a long while you probably did. How do you keep a finger on the pulse now when you get to 1,000 people? How do you...
Oh, well, you can't really. It's hard to keep your finger on the... You keep your finger on the pulse at the partner level, but you can't have a personal relationship with that number of people.
Mm.
You'd like to, but you can't. It's important to get to know people who have been with the organisation for a period of time, but even that's a challenge.
Mm.
I think people don't expect that I'm going to remember everybody's name or even that I've already met them twice or three times.
Mm. Mm. When you reflect on, you know, what you know now, what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self just starting off that you've learned the hard way and would have made life a little bit easier if you'd taken that on board when you were 20 years old?
Well, don't limit yourself. Don't put barriers around your capability and potential and what it is you can achieve, and develop a really resilience to jump hurdles and achieve whatever it is you feel you want to, consistent with the kind of lifestyle that you want to have.
And how do people put barriers around themselves? What are the things that they do that inhibit growth?
Well, I think it starts early with kids, you know. I can do that or I can't do that. You know, some people want to say that that's not for them, and it may not be for them, but if they'd like it to be for them, then they ought not to be having those barriers. But I don't know, that's a complex sociological question.
Yeah. Is there anything, it's been great to catch up, Danny, is there anything relevant that we haven't discussed around, you know, care in the workplace, performance in the workplace, things that make good organisations tick?
No, I mean, I think that building a culture where everybody feels valued and respected. I always say that doesn't matter who it is that gets out of the lift to come to work every day. They're a human being with their own needs, and they get out of the lift every day and come to work because the organisation has decided that they've got an important role to play in the firm. Mm. It doesn't matter how people might like to categorise that role in the hierarchy of roles, it's nonetheless an important role, and it demands respect.
Definitely. How long do you see yourself working for?
I don't know. As long as I'm upright.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I'll share some research, actuarial research, that basically says the younger you retire, the younger you die. So,
is that true?
That is true. So if you want to...
I thought that was just a bit of an urban myth or a cliche.
No, it's true, is it? If you're interested, I'll send you the evidence which shows it. But yeah, you know, I think.
Don't send me something I have to read. Right. I have no idea how many people every day send me something to read.
Well, I'll share another little bit of research. The Gallup organisation were looking at men that got to 95, and which was quite, you know, this was going back about 10 years ago, and they found out the average age that men that were at 95 retired was at 85. So, you know, I think if you're engaged, if you're active, and I think the way that you're constantly looking.
That's good. That means I've got 30 years left.
Very, very good news. Thanks very much, Danny. It's been a real pleasure catching up. And, you know, a real credit to you in terms of the organisation, the culture you've built. And I think that, you know, there's just so many younger people in your organisation that want to keep on evolving the business and that you're open to it. And it's wonderful to see.
Thank you.
All the best.
Thank you. I mean, I don't like talking about myself, but thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for joining us today. I hope you've learned something new and heard some practical tips you can try with your team. If you enjoyed this interview today, please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. When you rate us, it helps other people to find us. We also welcome any comments. If you are interested in seeing details about our scalable WeCare mental health training programs, please visit us at factorc.com.au. Our goal for these programs is to make them accessible, practical, and ongoing. If you've been impressed by a CEO that you would like us to interview, please email details to support@factorc.com.au. Please subscribe by clicking the button below. We really would love to have you as part of the care movement. Thanks for joining us.